At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Jay Bird Watching Podcast, the official podcast of JaysJournal.com and Fansided.com. We are the official ballroom chat for everything Toronto Blue Jays baseball, from game highlights to rumors and all the stuff in between. Here is your host, Craig Borden, with co-hosts Jason Lyons and Liz McGuire. Now let's talk some Toronto Blue Jays baseball.
Well, good evening, Blue Jays fans, and welcome to another awesome evening of Jay Bird Watching here on the Jay Bird Watching Podcast. So we got the normal gang with us this evening, Liz. Jason, how we doing?
Awesome.
Yeah, I love it. The best. Well, you know, it's so nice to have, you know, we've got a bit of an extended summer happening here in Vancouver. Last night, the Vancouver Canadians evened the series with the Spokane Indians with an incredible game. I couldn't go, but I listened to it while I was watching my son play hockey, which, I mean, is a little weird, but I was close enough. This is so interesting. I was close enough to the stadium that I could hear when they won inside the hockey arena, which is pretty cool for, I mean, this is low A baseball. You know, as you know, I interviewed a player a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying that the 6,000 people in that stadium sound a lot like 20,000 when they win. So that was Nick Goodwin. Big ups to Nick. He had a good game. But yeah, just, you know, kids baseball, kids hockey, nice weather. I can't really complain too much, can I?
Sports, and Birdman bats. That's the only
thing. Yeah, and nothing going on in baseball. Like Gordon Francis isn't a total animal. Bichette's not on his way back. You know, like, there's nothing happening.
I was at that no-hitter. Almost. I was at that almost no-hitter yesterday.
We're gonna get to that.
Yesterday. Almost, but almost bad.
Yeah, that would have been back-to-back if I was there. So, but anyways, before we get too far off the rails, we have a fourth gentleman here that is the man, the myth, the legend, two-time Blue Jays World Series champion, Todd Stottlemyre. How the hell are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Craig, Liz, Jason, listen, I guess I'm spoiling the party. You guys were the three amigos. So anyways, happy to be here. And, you know, it's funny, Liz, you were talking about that almost no-hitter. And that's twice for that young man. And, yep. You know, I was watching the highlight. Is that three times for him?
Yeah. He's done
yeah.
Taking it to the ninth inning three times.
Twice to the ninth, one to the seventh.
Oh, but the twice to the ninth was, I was watching it the other night on the highlights, and Lindor's coming up, and I'm like, no. And it was like they were baiting in this whole theatrical, you know, this whole scene. And I'm like, oh. And, you know, it reminded me of a guy by the name of Dave Steeb, who actually took a no-hitter to the ninth twice with two outs and in consecutive starts, by the way, and lost them both, but eventually threw a no-hitter. So the young man is, you know, obviously we're all going to root for him to throw a no-hitter. But more importantly, stay healthy, keep contributing. He looks like he's the real deal, and he's exciting to watch.
Yeah, it's interesting.
He looks like a great young guy, too, at the same time.
And he's had a big turnaround. He was a big prospect for the Jays, and he was kind of like a wild horse. And then they thought they had him corralled, and then he got out, and he couldn't find the strike zone, but he's back now. But I find it really interesting. I don't know if you guys saw this stat or not, but the three starts that he's had, his ERA for those three stats is the second lowest ever in history for three starts in a row. Jake DeGrom is the only one that has one lower. And then you know who the third one is behind him? Sandy Koufax. Like,
wow. That's,
God. You're talking about hallowed ground for three starts in a row. It's unbelievable. And all he's done is he's taken his fastball and moved it up. That's all he's done. He's not throwing it harder. And the catcher, what's his name again? Brian Servin. He's killing it back there. I mean, he is calling an incredible game. Francis is breaking pitches are all over the map, and then he rips this 94-mile-an-hour fastball just above where you think it's going to be. And it was untouchable. They look like no one can handle it right now, but so cool.
Well, you mentioned something, Liz, the catcher, right? And it's like a lot of times they don't get the credit they deserve. And yet, you know, you can get a pitcher on a streak or a hot streak. And really it's a dual effort, because the catcher in a lot of cases has a lot to do with it. And the more comfortable that starting pitcher is with that catcher, the less that pitcher has to think. And let me tell you something, you don't want us thinking too much out there, right? You really want us just thinking pitch to pitch and just about executing the pitch. And the beauty of having a catcher that you grow comfortable with and that really takes control of the game. Obviously, they do a lot of work pregame and you know, kind of the strategy and what they're going to do. But there's nothing like having a great catcher back there that is fighting for you. You know, look, we had Pat Borders for a number of years. And, you know, Pat probably never really got the credit he deserves as a receiver. I mean, he was the 92 World Series MVP, but at the same time, you know, I had a lot of great games with Pat, and you know, he cared as much as I did as far as my single performance, not just the team performance, not just winning the game, but he cared about me doing well. And when you have a guy like that, man, it means the world to a pitcher.
Todd, what does the catcher say when you're in a jam? Like, when they walk out there, like, what would be something that Pat would say to you? Is it like, does it help? Like, what is the secret?
Yeah, you know, I can't use all the language, but I'll try, you know. You know, there was a game actually that I was pitching against Baltimore, and I was throwing a shutout, and I think I had one out with a man on third, and Borders calls timeout. I don't know, we're winning probably 7-8-9-0. I don't know what the score was, but we had a big lead. That run on third base he wasn't going to affect the game. And it was the ninth inning, and Borders calls timeout, and I'm like, what's he doing? And comes out to the mound, and he says, hey, he says to me, look over there. And I'm like, where? He goes, look at third base. And I said, yeah. He says, you see that guy standing on third base? I said, yeah. He said, he's not scoring tonight. Do you understand me? And it's like, you know, as a pitcher, you know, you're like, yeah, you want the shutout, because the shutout is like a cool thing to have. Winning the game is the coolest thing. But he was kind of like, hey, we're not only going to win this game, but we've come this far. And it's like, we're getting a shutout tonight. So, you know, for him to just understand, you know, that piece and the importance of it. And then, you know, the whole thing, like I say, it had nothing to do with us winning or losing the game. I think that it was we were either winning 7-0 or 9-0. I mean, I would have to be really bad to screw it up at that point. But at the same time, he was like, look, man, we've worked this hard. Let's finish the race, right? And not in his words. They were much different words than I just said. But you kind of get the picture of – and that's the camaraderie between pitcher and catcher that you can't – it's irreplaceable. It really is.
Yeah.
Now, Todd, I have an interesting situation. I have 13-year-old twin boys – one who pitches to the other. I have a pitcher and a catcher. My catcher son, Carter, wanted me to ask, when you're waving off pitches, when you're shaking off pitches and he goes out there to talk to you and he says, hey, man, stop shaking me off, can you tell your brother to go to hell or not?
Yeah. I mean,
you have a brother in baseball too, who's currently with the Marlins organization too, Todd. So you know how it is.
You know, it's funny.
In baseball.
Yeah, and he's 17 months older. But you know, growing up, I always played up, so we always played together. And early on, when I say early on, I'll talk about when we were 12, 13. If one of us was pitching, the other one was catching. Yeah. But you know, I would tell you this at the major league level, which is kind of fun. You see guys shake. A lot of times it means nothing. Matter of fact, there's a sign the catcher actually gives the pitcher to just shake. And we're really only shaking sometimes for the psychology of the hitter, because hitters have gotten really smart that they'll hit off the patterns of the catchers. like no one talks about ever or even thinks about the game or at that level, but some hitters will get into a pattern with the catcher and understanding what the catchers typically call based on certain counts or certain game situations. So to combat this, sometimes catchers will simply give a sign to the pitcher, just shake me off a couple of times and we'll get right back to our game plan. So,
and there's the
but as far as one brother telling the other brother to go to hell, it won't be the first brother combination that ever said go to hell on
me. I don't think so.
No, it's too funny. So how was it? Obviously, like you said, your brother obviously is that only 17 months older than yourself. When you guys were coming up through the minor leagues and you played through college and everything, I know you weren't on the same teams. How was it with that kind of thing while you were going through the minors basically together?
Yeah, you know, what's funny is even though we were in the minor leagues at the same time, we never played against one another. But, you know, we did have one game. It was actually in Toronto. My brother was pitching with the Kansas City Royals. And I was the starting pitcher in that game. And I think I got knocked out like in the, maybe the third or fourth inning. My brother was in the bullpen for the Royals. He actually came in to pitch in that game. I just didn't pitch long enough that game to stay in the game long enough to where we could have been pitching against one another. So he had a great game that game. I stunk. I was terrible. And I was actually already showered up and sitting in my locker watching my brother on TV in the Toronto Blue Jays clubhouse. So,
well, it's too fun. But at the end of the day, at least you got to share that, even regardless of what was going on that day. I'm sure you guys got to go out and have a beer afterwards and enjoy the fact that you were in town in the big league.
His beer tasted a lot different than mine.
Yeah, yours had tears in it. It was like a little salty, maybe.
Mine was bitter.
Yeah.
His was sweet. Mine was bitter, you know.
Yeah. And like yourself, he played on plenty of good Kansas City teams. So one of the questions I wanted to make sure we asked you, you had the benefit of playing not just through your minor league career with the Blue Jays, but when you got up to the show, playing with some of the names of names in Major League Baseball and grow up with some of those guys. And then you get the Carters and Alomars and whatnot that are able to join the team and push you guys really over the top in 92, 93. What was it like coming up with all that talent and basically having to put your nose to the grindstone and work to get with all those guys to make it all the way up to the show?
Yeah. So, you know, look, I was in awe when I, you know, my first year was 1988 and I might be on record for the worst starting pitcher in baseball in 1988, but I was young and trying to fight my way through it. But, you know, I will never forget the outfield, right? It's like, left field is George Bell, center field is Mosby, right field is Barfield, Tony Fernandez is your shortstop. I mean, and over at first base was two guys, one Cecil Fielder and the other one Fred McGriff. And you know, you kind of go, you got Gruber over at third. And it's crazy when you look at those names and that talent of that team. And then the pitching staff was Clancy, Flanagan, Key, Steve, and then me. And it's like,
come on, give yourself some credit.
I think Flanagan was, you know, our age gap was, you know, I mean, I think he was probably late 30s, early 40s. And here I am in my, you know, 21, 22. He was old enough to be my father probably. But, you know, I had a lot of respect for those guys. They took me under their wing. It was incredible. And then, you know, we got close and that team kept getting close. And then, you know, you mentioned, you know, guy by the name of Devon White shows up, Joe Carter shows up, Roberto Alomar shows up, Dave Winfield shows up, Paul Molitor shows up, Jack Morris shows up. I mean, you start, David Cone shows up. I mean, it's like, and think about all these names. And by the way, it was an era in the city of Toronto where the stars of Major League Baseball wanted to go to Toronto and they wanted to play for the Toronto Blue Jays because of what that team and the city and the country, what they had created. And it was the creation and it was the beginning of baseball in the city of Toronto, you know. But, you know, and it was really truly because of the leadership. You know, it started with Paul Beeston. And, you know, you think Paul Beeston, Pat Gillick, Cito Gaston, every major league star wanted to go be a part of that. And that was the coolness of it. At the trading deadline, you know, we could add a big name. you know, when the, if the team needed it, because guys actually wanted to go play there, or in the off season, you know, you could get a big name free agent. I mean, go 1991, right? We crush it in the East and we get beat by the Minnesota Twins in 1991 in the playoffs. And then how did the team respond? Well, we'll sign Dave Winfield. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you don't just sign him. You know, he had to want to go there.
Yep.
But he seen what was going on in Toronto, and he, you know, and he could feel the family and the culture and the atmosphere and the guys and how close it was. You know, Dave Winfield went there not just to sign to play another year, but he was looking at that club saying that club could win a world championship, and he happens to be the missing link, right? And then at the end of 92, you know, we win the world championship, and then, you know, Winfield moves on, and then who do they bring in next? How about Hall of Famer Paul Molitor? I'm like,
why not?
So, you know, and here I am a player on the team, and it's kind of like, man, you know, they're trading one Hall of Famer for another to come in, and they just keep elevating the club. And then the guys there, like Alomar and Morris, that, you know, are future Hall of Famers. And how about they bring in Dave Stewart in 1993 with Paul Molitor? And then eventually Ricky Henderson in 1993 is playing left field. I mean, come on, man. It's like when you start to think and you look at some of those teams, I look at it as a fan too. I was in awe. Like, hey, I was a fan of those guys, you know, so it was pretty incredible.
Todd, what was the clubhouse culture like there? Like, what was the vibe? Was it like you had a lot of big names? Was it like full of egos, or was it like a pretty positive place?
No, you know what? It was like check the ego at the door mentality. It was like, you know, and you're right. There was star players, big egos. But when you walked in that locker room, your ego and all of that crap was like, you check it at the door because you're just one of 25 on the team. So you're no bigger, you're no greater than the guy to the left of you in that locker room or to the guy to the right of you in that locker room. And by the way, it has to be that way, because if it's not that way and you start abusing the rules or this or that, or try to become too big amongst the gang, the gang will start to disrespect you as a player. And those are the cracks that start to happen. You know, but look, it was really cool. It was Winfield was like, Molitor was the same way. When the team stretched, you had to be out on the field stretching. None of this BS like, hey, I'm in the training room getting a rub down or this or that, or I have a special program. No, when the team was doing stretching pregame, you had to be out there. There wasn't an option. And by the way, that was not Cito's rule. That was the rule of the players. Like, we're coming together to start this day. We're going to come together and we're going to stay together as a ball club. And by the way, it carried over. And that's one of the ways that you get rid of the prima donna syndrome of I'm on this program or I'm not going to take BP today. It was like, you never seen Winfield and Molitor miss BP ever, by the way. You never seen them miss stretching. And by the way, the other thing that Winfield did was, which is incredible, is, you know, you see a lot of guys go back and forth in the locker room during the game, right, that aren't playing. And if you aren't on the bench, Winfield would go in the locker room and drag you to the bench. And by the way, he's big enough man to drag anyone to the bench. So,
well, he was a football player in college too, wasn't he?
Yeah, man, for sure. But look, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, it was everyone pulling the same rope. Everyone individually wanted to have a great year. But you know what? They didn't want to have a great year for themselves. They wanted to have a great year for the team, because the ultimate goal was win a world championship. And anything less in those years, 92, 93, even in 94, even though it was a messed up year, 91 was the same way, but we fell short. The goal was to win a world championship. And anything less than winning a world championship is a failure. That means we didn't – it wasn't about getting to the playoffs. It was like, screw getting to the playoffs. I mean, who wants to get to the playoffs and then go home? I'm like, no, the idea is not to get to the playoffs. It's to dominate the playoffs. It's not just to get to a World Series. The goal was never to get to the World Series. The freaking goal was to win a world championship. And I think sometimes that may get lost throughout. You know, I'm not saying it does or doesn't. I'm just telling you the way it was. And it was like, you know, I had a guy like Dave Stewart tell me in 1993, and I remember first day of spring training, and he said, Todd, what kind of year are you going to have? I'm like, shit, bro, it's the first day of spring training. I hadn't even thought about it. And he goes, I need you to start thinking about it because I'm going to have a – he told me, he looked right at me. He says, Todd, I'm going to have a great year, but it's not going to be enough. I need you to have a great year too because we're going to win a world championship together. I'm like –
And that's what a team is.
That's what a team is. So,
I mean, Todd, so it's so interesting you would say all this because I think that, you know, like the current situation of the Blue Jays in the last, you know, little while of the Blue Jays, a lot of the fans have thought that this sort of star pack lineup that they were trying to create was going to be able to toe the line, as you so eloquently put it. But do you think, like, I watch a lot of ball, I watch a lot of guys, and I'm a big fan of that era of baseball player, and it just seems like that team of Blue Jays appear to be really good friends that stayed really good friends. Like, you see some, you know, you see, like, a retirement of a jersey in New York or in, you know, where Philadelphia or wherever, and they drag a couple of guys out there, and they're like, great, awesome, I haven't talked to this guy. And every time a Jay has anything happen from that group of guys, 91 through 95, I would even say, the guys that come out and are willing to come out and look unbelievably happy to do it, do you feel like that kind of camaraderie was built in and that's what helped you guys just, you know, be as good as you were?
Kind of, you know, look, I just think it came naturally because everyone, you know, shared in the same goal, and that was winning. And yeah, there were guys that played bigger roles, that were bigger stars, that we won because of them. Like, I'm not stupid. I understand that. I get that, right? It's like, you know, it's not everyone played equal roles, right? It's like, thank God for Robbie Alomar. You know, thank God for some of those star players. But, you know, they never became bigger than the team. And because of the closeness, you know, that's crazy. You know, it's been so fun over the years. You know, you kind of go back for a reunion. And when you go back for a reunion, it's like the camaraderie never left. And I think that in fairness, you know, I think that when you win and you win it all, you become family and you become a brotherhood forever. You know, we share in the ring and the trophy and the last man standing mentality, and you know, whether you performed well or didn't perform to be on that team. Look, it's so funny because, you know, I was a lot better pitcher after I left Toronto. You know, I was young and immature and trying to find my way. I became a pretty good pitcher after I left Toronto, you know, and here I am, I'm about a 500 pitcher on great clubs, so that's not very good. But when you look back on it, it's like, and if I look back over my career over 15 years, I probably couldn't tell you about a bunch of great performances I did, you know, as a pitcher. You know, not that I didn't have a handful, right? But that's not the point. All the great memories, and let me tell you about the team or this guy or that guy or this situation. It's like, but I've been around guys, and unfortunately, that they're going to tell you how great they were. And sometimes I look at them, I say, hey, man, good for you. I don't really give a damn how good you were. My question is, did you win? I love the fact that, you know, I'll go to my grave knowing that, hey, look, I was a guy from the United States that became Canadian, that was played on two world championships in Toronto, and I'm forever grateful. By the way, I am so freaking grateful that I got to play in Canada and that I got to be on world championship teams. And I just feel like, man, those teams and that time in Canada blessed my entire life. So I'm forever grateful of it. And I think that until you understand what that win is really like.
I got to tell you, Todd, so this is one of the most Canadian things that you can possibly do, although it's baseball related. So I was playing a hockey game the same night that Joe Carter hit the faithful home run. So I was on the ice, and as the play would stop, we'd all look up at the bar, and people would bang and give us scores. So we finished our game. I came off the ice. I took off my gloves and my helmet and my skates, and I went into the bar in full gear. I watched an inning and a half. I watched that home run go, and then two people dumped pitchers of beer over my head. My gear never smelled worse. I probably had to burn it all, and it was the happiest. I mean, I can't even, you know, being a fan of the Jays as long as I had been and was, it was just, and I think, Craig, you know, like one of the things we wanted to ask you is, you know, I mean, you were there. You were sitting 50 feet away from that, and I've watched the replay, and the noise that that ball made when he hit it was just, I mean, it was like you could feel it in your chest. Can you just tell us what it was like to be sitting there, hear that sound with Mitch Williams staring him down, and just watch it go?
Well, I'm going to mess your story up because I was actually warming up in the bullpen to come in the game. If it was going to be a tie game.
That's right.
Okay, now this is crazy. Now listen to this. This is, it's almost hilarious. So I'm warming up in the bullpen, and all of a sudden you hear the roar of the crowd, and then the ball comes over the left field, which is where the Jays bullpen was, right? And the crowd goes freaking ballistic. They open up the door to the bullpen. The guys are all coming down off the deal. We're all running out there. I'm gonna tell you, it's hilarious. I'm like, holy shit, I don't even know what just happened, but I think we're world champions. Hey, and so I want you to know something. You got to see something live. I didn't get to see live on the TV. So it was like, you know, I've watched Joe Carter hit that home run about 10,000 times since then. But the funny thing is when I didn't even know who hit the home run, or I just know there was a ball came over the fence. We're all running out there. I'm like, it's the craziest thing because, you know, you're running down the deal and you want to get in the pile and like, holy shit, we're world champions. And I'm like, I don't know who hit the freaking home run.
Excited to be there at that point, right?
You know, I'm just like,
happy to be here.
You know, so
that's great.
It was crazy. Yeah, it was good times, man.
So on that note, though, in that same World Series, you probably pitched in probably one of the craziest World Series baseball games, I'd say, in history. The one question that is burning a hole through our Reddit and our chat window and everything is here. Do you still own the starter jacket?
I don't. You know, I wish I did.
The jacket you were wearing when you slid to third base.
Yeah, no, I don't. I wish I did. There'd be blood all over it, and we could auction it off and give money to kids tonight. So that sucks.
There you go.
That freaking jacket. I'm just kidding.
On that note, being a part of that game, the literal crazy ups, downs, all that, being on the mound for your first World Series after having a few good playoff performances, what was it like that night in the ballpark?
Well, you know, it was crazy. It was, you know, it was cool, and there was the off and on with the rain or whatever. But at the end of the day, we got to play the game, you know. And what was crazy is, you know, I have to go hit now. I haven't picked up a bat in a long time as an American League pitcher in the ballpark. And Tommy Green was the opposing pitcher, and he ends up walking me. And I get down to first base, and Kruk at first base, he's like, man, he says, too bad for you tonight. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, look, bro. And he goes, that umpire doesn't call any strikes. He goes, you're not even – here's what he said. He says, you're not going to believe the final score of where this game is going to end up. He goes, it's going to be something like – this is no joke. He goes, this is going to be something like 15-14, 14-13. Now, that's what Kruk said, like, in the first or second inning, whenever I walked down there. And
oh, my God.
And then, of course, it turned out that way. But, you know, it was a crazy game. And, you know, it was but it was the one game that really changed the trajectory of the rest of my career because – you know, I was so upset that I got caught up in the emotions of what the mayor was talking about. And I got caught up in the pregame, you know, I got caught up in the pregame because when I went in to do the pregame interviews, you know, you do as a starting pitcher. So the only time you do pregame interviews is in a World Series or in playoffs or in a World Series. And I go in there and, you know, we're in Philly and, of course, the national media, and they're all chirping about the mayor said this and the mayor said that. And you know, I got wrapped up into that deal emotionally and mentally and tossed and turned all night. So when it was time to pitch against the Phillies, I probably wasn't mentally and emotionally ready because all I could think about was this stupid ass mayor and what he said. And it really ultimately, you know, I remember my dad said, he got you, man. He baited you and he got you. And, you know, it's kind of like one of the things I teach today. If you give somebody what you're thinking or your emotions, you give those people your power over you. And it was a great lesson for me, but it was the lesson that also forced me that said, hey, I want to go get help because I want to be better than this. And I want to be better on the field. I want to be better off the field. And it truly led me to conversations with the guru of, you know, the mental game of baseball, which was a guy by the name of Harvey Dorfman. And working with Harvey, you know, and if you look at pre-Harvey, post-Harvey, and you look at me statistically, I'm a completely different pitcher. And it's almost like what happened. And some people will say, well, you know, he got older and he finally matured, you know, which probably was partly the case. Because, you know, when I was in Toronto, man, my hair was on fire. You know, I was ready. But it was, you know, it was all good. They were all lessons. Everything was a lesson to work towards the getting better and that sort of thing. So anyways, I'm not sure why we got into all of that, but there you got it.
Well, I don't think we could do justice to a Todd Stottlemyre interview without at least bringing up the fact that, you know, you told the mayor of Philly to kiss your ass, which was,
yeah, of course. I mean, yeah.
It's so good, dude. Like, so good.
You know, it's funny. I don't know how funny it is, but funny, I guess. But, you know, and it was crazy because some people loved it. You know, and being in the Sky Dome after the parade, you know, 50,000 people in there, like the stadium erupted when I said it. Now, you know, I wasn't smart enough to realize that it was live on CNN at the time. So the world was watching it. And then the amount of hate mail that I got from Philadelphia was off the charts, you know. And I mean, big old garbage bags full of it. But the funny thing about it is, you know, kind of when I got home to Florida for the winter, I was like, I started to think about the whole situation. I actually called the mayor's office and I was like, I had a great idea. I was like, you know, why doesn't he actually hit against me and we'll raise money for charity and the benefit will be, you know, underprivileged kids in Philadelphia, underprivileged kids in Canada. We could do something good with all of this mess. So I called the mayor's office and I'll never forget the answer. And I was like, hey, can I speak to Mayor Rendell? And they said, who's calling? I said, yeah, this is Todd Stottlemyre. And they go, oh, hold on one second. Put me on a hold, came back and they said, the mayor's not available. I said, of course not. You know, so he never took my call. I never got a chance to challenge him and say, hey, let's do something for kids. But you know, so be it, you know.
I'm surprised you just didn't get the exact quote back or something. The secretary in the office.
Yeah, he should have told the secretary to tell Stottlemyre to kiss my ass. You know,
yes, that's what he should have done.
We would have been even. You know.
Yeah.
Todd, so, I gotta ask. Sorry, what? I gotta ask Todd. How does it feel to be one of the rare pitchers to body slam a whole man on the mound?
Who are you talking about? I know who you're talking about.
Yep. Like, how did you feel after that? Like, you must have been full of adrenaline. Like, what happens kind of after there's a scuffle on the mound like that? Like,
well, you know, it was kind of a weird situation because we were in Cleveland at the time, and you're talking about Mitch Webster, but we would, you know, back then you'd play a club at home, and then you would go play them on the road right away. And if something happened in one of the series, you know, the emotions would carry over to the next series. Well, I think there were some guys that got hit on the Blue Jays, right? And there was some emotions running high on guys getting hit, this and that, and then we get to Cleveland, and what's funny is I didn't even try to hit Mitch, and I think if I did try to hit Mitch, well, first of all, he wouldn't be the guy I would hit.
Yeah.
So no disrespect, but I would hit the biggest, baddest guy on the team to send the right message, right? And with no disrespect to Mitch, but when I hit him, it kind of shocked me when he was running at me.
Yeah.
And in my shock, my reaction was like, dude, you're not running at me. I'm going to come get you. So I threw my glove and I decided that, like, and I was almost mad that he was like he was coming to the mound, because I'm like, dude, I hit you like in the thigh and I didn't even try to hit you. I was trying to run a ball in on him. But here we go. That was a crazy game, because when I look back on it, you know, I think he got thrown out. I actually didn't get thrown out of that game, which was crazy. And it was a really hard game to continue to pitch, because honestly, all I wanted to do was fight at that point. You know,
up on the adrenaline there, Todd.
You know, my emotions were flying. So, but we ended up winning that game, which was the most important. But I mean, look, it kind of sucks for Mitch that, you know, there's still people see that video and they're like, man, you ran to the mound. That guy just whipped your behind, you know. But at the same time, it's like, I almost think it's funny. It's like, because I had a lot of guys, you know, I hit a lot of big guys. You know, I remember I hit Koseko in the chest one time and he kind of wiped it off and looked out at me and like, hey, no big deal, you little punk. And then went to first base.
Clearly a flesh wound. Keep moving on.
I had plenty of guys that were big guys that I'm like, dear God, I'm drilling them, but I hope they don't chase me down. But
So I guess I'm going to lead this into one of the questions I actually had, because obviously you're pitching a completely different era of baseball than what we currently have going on these days, where we have pitch counts, pitch clocks, pitch everything at this point. What are your thoughts, you know, having like literally having that kind of like gassed up and get ready to go and just being in that kind of mental part of the game? We talked about earlier that maybe, you know, not thinking as much and having a pitch clock and just rifling back and throw it maybe can help some guys. We've seen it. What are your thoughts on some of the things as far as what's changed in the game since you played for pitchers?
You know, the pitch clock, when they talked about the pitch clock, I wasn't my first reaction to it was, or thought was, I wasn't a big fan. And I'm kind of like, I don't understand. But the more I've watched it, I'm actually a big fan of it. You know, now I know it's like, and everyone talks about the pitchers, you know, and circling around the mound and taking forever. But how about the hitters stepping out and fixing batting gloves, and I got to fix my elbow deal guard, and I got to fix the guard on my leg and tap my helmet a few times and get it. So all of that now is, we're just getting to the meat, right? It's like, hey, the hitter can't step out and go through all those routines, so they had to make a change. The pitcher's got so much time and they got to deliver that pitch, so they've had to make, but you know, I think the game is more entertaining because there's not all of that BS, right? So I think that for me, I liked it. Pitch counts, I've never been a big fan. And the reason I've never been a big fan of pitch counts is because I still think there's a lack of understanding of pitch counts. It's not how many pitches. It's stress on each pitch is what counts. So I'll give you an example. You know, if our team scores a bunch of runs early, you know, I'm not going to be pitching in that game under a lot of stress if I'm winning 5, 6, 7, 0. So let's just hypothetically say I throw 115 pitches, 120 pitches that night, and I win 7-0, 7-1, 7-2. I never had stress on those pitches during that game. So I will tell you that the next day I feel like I can pitch again. Now I could now go to the next game and I'm in trouble every inning. Runners on base, pitching out of jams, throw 90 pitches, and I feel like I got run over by a truck the next day. And I'm just saying is, like, if a guy is cruising and they say, well, he's at 100 pitches, I got to put the pillow over my head because I don't want to hear the whole neighborhood hear me screaming watching the game on TV because it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever witnessed in my life. Now, what's crazy is Major League Baseball is now trying to make a change, right? They're going to try to revert back. I heard some rule where they say that starting pitchers, they're thinking about saying that they have to pitch six innings. Mm-hmm. And I'm like,
basically a quality start rule at that point. Listen, is kind of how it sounded, I think.
Let me say it this way. I had games in streaks where I couldn't get to the fifth inning, where I'd given up 7-8 runs. Matter of fact, one game in St. Louis, I gave up 11 runs and didn't close the fifth inning out. So if they make the rule you got to stay in for six innings, are you trying to tell me after giving up 11 runs through five, I got to go out and pitch the sixth inning? See, it doesn't even make sense. We're thinking about this the wrong way.
Yeah.
And it's like with all the analytics and all the science, can someone please measure the stress that a pitcher goes through in a 1-0 game or a tight game or getting out of jams versus a game where he's just dealing and rolling through it? I mean, it's different. It's a different stress. Look, it's the difference. Could you imagine sprinting for 26 miles in a marathon?
That's, like, I mean, I'm with you 100%, Todd. And I think that, you know, a lot of what you're speaking to, you know, also sort of speaks to what you're involved with now with the mental side of the game. And I couldn't agree with you more. I don't think that we give the human enough credit sometimes. And I think we worry on things that are outside of that human's control. And, you know, if you could rewind that playoff game, you know, for the Jays in Minnesota, where they, you know, they go out and they make a pitching change just based on a number. And you're like, he's dealing though. And why would you stop this from happening? And I mean, if you go out there and he says, my elbow's killing me, by all means, pull him. Even if he's still throwing 97, pull him. Mm. Don't go out there and say, hey, you're coming up on 100 pitches. This is going to be your last guy. Like, what?
Why?
Like, no. So on the mental side of things, Todd, like, how did you, I mean, back when you were pitching, again, you know, it probably wasn't something that was discussed very much, but how did you guys deal with, you know, a really hard, the reason I'm asking is my son gave up a really big home run in the Western Canadian semifinals this year. It was a tank. It might have had a stewardess on it. We're not sure if it's landed yet. If he hears this, he's probably going to kill it. So he was crushed. He went into the dugout. He was pulled immediately. We had to pull him in. But he's a specialist lefty pitcher that really got a lot of quality batters out this year, and he happened to hang one. So what would your advice be, you know, with the mental part of this in mind, to be able to get back up off the horse and be asked to go play left field for possibly the most important inning of your 13-year-old baseball career?
Yeah, well, it happened. I was helping out with my son's club team this past summer. We were in Tennessee, so playing in a tournament, so similar to your son. And that day, we just had that day as a team where, you know, we were kicking the ball around, dropping fly balls. It's like three guys are calling for a fly ball and running into one another. And we give up 14 runs in the game. And about the fourth inning, I said to the head coach, I said, we might as well get these guys off the field and start, you know, putting other guys in. And my son is the shortstop. And it would be what I would tell your son. And I would tell the young man the same thing is, and I remember the whole infield, and the whole infield probably made like 8-9 errors. Like they were man, it was like a soccer game. They were kicking more balls than they were fielding. But they got to the dugout. I put my arms around three or four of the guys. And here's what I said to them. I said, hey guys, if we all play long enough, you're going to have this game again. So what I need you to do is I need you to forget it as fast as you can. so that we can get ready and go play baseball again tomorrow. And here's the
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thing. Here's what I would tell you. Look, I understand. It's like there's nothing worse than having a performance where, you know, and it maybe cost the team a win or nothing like. Look, I know I felt that pain, right? Where if you don't do your job that day, the reason we didn't win this baseball game was maybe because I didn't do my job or something happened or I screwed something, whatever it was. So I know the pain of what that is, but it also, you know, you have to have to where your memory is short term. Like, and you have to understand that, okay, well, what if you would have played great? It's still just one game. Mm-hmm. And by the way, 50 years from now, probably no one's going to be talking about that game now, you know, or 100 years or five, whatever it is. So literally we put too much weight on one game, right? Versus just doing everything you can. And you know, I always tell people, man, sow the seeds. It's just like, you know, just focus and do everything that you can do. And whether it works out that day or not, tomorrow's the new game. Tomorrow's the new day. My dad used to tell me, he'd say, hey, he'd tell me when we were growing up and, you know, if we had a tough game or if I had a tough game, he'd call me from New York and I was in Toronto and he'd say, hey, kid, sun's going to come up tomorrow. I said, yeah, Dad, I can't sleep. I'm going to watch it come up. Like, I'm so upset and, like, you know, I wish you could, you know, all those things. And trust me, I had nights in Toronto where I'm like, you know what, I'm waiting on it. I'm waiting on the sun. And I would tell myself, I'm going to go ahead and wallow in this pain and suffering and feeling sorry for myself. And I need my job. But when that sun does come up, I'm turning a leaf and I'm going to get ready for my next start. So it's not an easy thing to do, especially as a young, you know, as a young kid and this and that. But it's like, you know, as a dad or as a coach, that's where you put your arm around them, you know, and that's when you tell them, say, hey, man, whether you would have hit that home run or you gave up that home run, I love you just the same. And you gave it everything you got. Let me give you some knuckles. And tomorrow, by the way, let's see what we can do. Let's give it back to them, you know. But, you know, the important thing for a kid, especially for a young kid, is to know his coaches, you know, and his family still got his back, right? That's so important for a young player, you know.
Yep. The mantra that my dad beat into me and my brother playing sports when younger, he's from a family of football players all the way through high school, state champion kind of stuff, was the mantra of no brains, no headache. Just get it out of your head. Move on to the next thing. So that was always the mantra. You had a bad day, just don't think about it. Move on.
Yeah.
But baseball is a game of failure when you really look at it. Every, you know, the best players in Major League Baseball history get a hit a third of the time. You know, it's that simple. So,
well, you know, Don, it's crazy, but, you know, all sports, you know, it's like no one succeeds in any sport all the time. You know, it's like, you know, it's funny. And then I'll turn it back to you real quick. But, you know, there's games that, like, where I pitched great or it looked like I pitched great. The results were great. Let me just say that, you know, maybe I didn't give up much and we won the game. And, you know, and the reporters would come and they're like, wow, Todd, you know, great game. You didn't make any mistakes tonight. And I'd be thinking to myself, no, I made 10 mistakes. I got away with every one of them.
Yep.
And then the opposite could happen. You can make every pitch you wanted to make and still not, and then have bad results. And they're like, well, it seems like you just made too many mistakes tonight. And I would get so mad. I was like, no, actually, I threw that pitch exactly where I wanted to, you know. But you know, sometimes we don't see because we're just witnessing scoreboards and what does it all look like? But at the end of the day, you know, especially as pitchers, we know when we get away with them. And by the way, you have to get away with them. You have to get away.
That's true.
I mean, the game is perfect. But people don't realize how freaking hard the game is.
Yeah.
And whether that's football, hockey, soccer, basketball, baseball at that level, those freaking games are hard, man. Because those other guys we're playing against, they've worked just as hard. They're just as committed. They're just as disciplined. They're just as talented. So it's freaking hard, you know?
So Todd, I don't know how much time you got, but we usually have an hour, but I'm having a blast. If you want to hang out for a little bit longer than an hour, I'm
whatever you guys want.
All right. So on that note, I did have one because you're kind of going down this avenue. That was one that we actually got on one of our social media channels was who had your number and who did you actually own during your career? So as far as who you maybe shut down, I don't. Some star that you always seem to be able to get down on, and who was the one that seemed to always have that trick against you at the end of the day?
Well, a lot of guys had my number. You know, well, I'll tell you, you know, it varied. You know, early in my career, Jose Canseco just killed me, right? It was like you just knew he was hitting a bomb somewhere. And early in my career against the A's, I think Jose got me 9 different times. That's a lot, right? And one game, I pitched a complete game in Toronto, and I lost 5-4 against the Oakland A's. And Canseco was like 2-for-3 with 2 home runs and 5 RBIs. So if I get him out, he'll shut up, right? So he was definitely one of those guys. In the National League, Chipper Jones was real tough on me. You know, oddly enough, I did pretty well against Bonds. I did pretty well against Griffey. I did really well against a guy like by the name of Robin Yount. He would never want me to say that, by the way.
Especially his old teammate and your teammate.
Well, he's a friend of mine, and you know, I hear this Hall of Famer, and he swore, he goes, "Stop, there's just no way you ever got me out." I'm like, "Bro, I'm telling you, man, you were like 1-for-19 against me." He goes, "I must have hit 19 line drives, you know." So and I said, yeah, but they were out. But
they're all out. For a guy that did hit mostly on the screws, and the reason why he's a Hall of Famer at the end of the day, too.
I'll just say that, you know, like early in my career, for some reason, I pitched really well against the Orioles. At one time, I was 8-0 against Baltimore. Seemed like I always pitched well against the Yankees. When I went to the National League, I pitched well against the Mets. I loved beating those guys in New York. I don't know. At the end of the day, but you know, there definitely were guys that I pitched against over the course of years where you're like, that's not the guy you want to beat you. And, you know, you'd have to kind of get them out of your head. But Ricky Henderson was another one of those guys, like, irritated me. I either walked him, he got a base hit, he even took me deep. It's like, you know, he probably hit 380 off of me, which is, you know, that's really good, you know, so. But you think about it, it's like Ricky hit 380 off me, right? So that means out of 10 plate appearances, I still got him out 6 times.
Right.
But, you know, when someone hits 380 off of you, it feels like you never get them out. It's the weirdest.
The game of failure part that we were talking about there.
It's like, hey, I got you out 6 times, but it feels like I never got you out once, right? So Chipper Jones was that way against me. So, anyways. Matt Noakes is another one. I mean, this freaking guy, right? He also hit 9 bombs off me. And I got a funny story about Matt. So I pitched in Detroit when I was with the Blue Jays, and I got a shutout going into the 9th inning, 2 outs in Detroit. Matt Noakes comes up, first pitch, hits a bomb. Now, I still win the game, but no shutout. 5 days later, all right, I'm pitching in New York. Noakes gets traded from Detroit to the Yankees. It's on Father's Day. I have a shutout in New York. It's like 9-0. We scored a bunch of runs. I got a shutout. Noakes isn't in the lineup. With 2 outs in the 9th inning, they pinch hit Noakes. First pitch. Listen.
Oh, man.
First pitch, he goes bomb. And I'm like, so I would tell you that he's one of those guys that, like, I might shiver if I see him, you know, because it's like, God almighty, you know.
That's pretty funny. And those are the reasons why we love having you on or and other people on this show. Is we like collecting stories and making sure the Blue Jays fans and everybody get a chance to hear these kind of stories. That's a great story that unless you were here to tell that, we would have never known something like that. And what were the odds that he was going to get traded within 5 days and then be that guy that did that again? And yeah, you're talking minuscule.
First pitch both times with two outs in the ninth where I had a shutout. Dang it, man.
Do you ever get flowers sent to the house and they have no tag on them and you're like, I wonder who sent these?
No, but I had some guys that, you know, say, hey, Scott, did you get the flowers and the lunch and the bottle of wine? I wanted to make sure, you know, you're going to be good for the game because I need you to pitch against me tonight, you know. So,
here's the mental games that we were talking about all over again. So, Todd, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about your post-baseball career because you've had just as great of a success in your after-baseball career between being, you know, stocks and then obviously being, you know, the book that I've happened to read. And I feel bad that I didn't know you read you wrote another one with Relentless Success in the Observer and obviously being a success coach. Tell some of the Blue Jays fans first how you got into doing that. Obviously, you have a plethora of stories and have built yourself up. I'm sure it was a lot of that that got you to where you are.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of crazy because, you know, I retired at 37 from Major League Baseball. And if you look at my childhood, it was my dad playing Major League Baseball. And then, you know, and then in my adulthood, I'm playing Major League Baseball. So the first 37 years of my life was Major League Baseball. So, but when I retired, you know, I was having kids late and I had some young kids and I knew if I had stayed in the game that I was going to miss dinners and taking them to school and all those things. And, you know, I really wanted to be a dad. So I knew I was going to, in order to do that and be a dad and be home with my kids and raise my kids, I'm just going to have to reinvent myself. And, you know, I started out where, you know, I took 6-8 months off. I went to work for a Wall Street firm and I built an asset management team and the collection of the team, you know, it was, once again, it was a team. And for me, it was all about being on teams, building teams. And in this case, you know, I built a team of great pedigree. We were extremely successful. But I woke up one, after about 5-6 years in the business, I woke up one morning and just decided I was going to make it my last day. And I just didn't see myself working in an office the rest of my life. And I wanted to go do something different. And we were lucky that we had the resources that I could just change my mind. And then I went and I'll tell you how smart I am. I went from one office to another. I launched a hedge fund and I went from one office and I'm back in an office. And I thought, you know, I always wanted to do it or I thought I wanted to do it. And so, but 8 months into it, I was like, this lifestyle is brutal. And so we kind of shut that down, collapsed it, returned all the capital and we've done really well, but it wasn't about doing well. It was about me finding my next hatch. And so far I'm over 2. I messed around with a marketing company. And then my dad got, you know, was going through multiple myeloma and was really struggling. And I'll never forget that, you know, I happened to be up in Seattle and he was in ICU and he was there for 3 days and then we got him out of the hospital and I'll never forget it because he refused to get in the wheelchair. He wanted to walk out of the hospital. And, you know, the doctors were in disbelief because they really didn't think he was going to get out of ICU. They thought that was going to be his resting place. But he led our family out of the hospital and, you know, growing up in Yankee Stadium, of course it was, you know, a huge influence on my life. Watching him fight cancer was the single largest influence on my life. I was watching a warrior fight for his life every day. But when he led our family out of the hospital, we were kind of all in disbelief. And then when we got home, he said to me, he said, Todd, you want to take a drive in the mountains? And I was like, whatever you want, Dad. And so I'm driving his pickup truck and we're going up and we're in Snoqualmie and all of that up in the mountains. And there's cabins. It's beautiful. And he says to me while I'm driving, he says, you know, Todd, maybe one of these days I'll buy a cabin up here for me and your mom. And I was like, Dad, I'm thinking to myself, he's talking about someday buying a cabin for himself and my mom, his wife, and I'm thinking, I just want you to get through the day. How in the world could you have vision, long-term vision for your life going through the battles you're going through? And I remember when we got home, and then later that night, you know, I go to bed in the guest room, and I'm looking at the ceiling. It's like 3 a.m, and I'm like, I was just like, it just was like unbelievable, because I realized when I look back at that, I'm like, it didn't matter his circumstances. You know, he didn't wallow him, you know, and he wasn't allowing his current circumstances to destroy the way he thought and the way he felt and about life. He just would refuse it. And I remember thinking to myself that night that, man, my father's poured into my life. I've had great people like the Cito Gassons of the world pour into my life. I've had, you know, incredible mentors and people that have poured into my life. And that night I realized all of these people have poured into me to have success so that I could be the best version of myself. But what I realized that night, I was like the Dead Sea. I had never poured into someone else's life. I had never shared the stories of people helping me when I was struggling so bad, right? And I thought to myself, that's it, you know, and I'm gonna be more like my father. And I went home, I went down the stairs the next morning. My father was sitting in his chair drinking a cup of coffee. And I said, Dad, I'm gonna write a book. And he said, you should. And I said, Dad, I didn't tell you what I was gonna write my book on yet.
Checkbox.
And he goes, well, what are you gonna write a book on? I said, I'm gonna write a book on all the lessons. And he was like, oh, I can't wait for this book. I'm like, you can't wait for this book? And I was just like, I mean, that's just the way he was. And you know, he had the ability that when you were around my father, you always felt better about yourself than you did prior to interacting with him. And I was like, man, I want to be more like him. So I wrote the book, and then I started coaching and helping companies and CEOs or whoever would want me to come and speak. And I realized that it was my next passion. And what I realized, it was my Major League Baseball for me all over again, because, you know, today my whole mission is, I don't know much. And when I'm talking to people, I say, listen, I don't know much, but if you get everything that you can from me, right, and I have experienced some things, and you can gain all of my experiences and then stand on my head, use it for a trampoline, and catapult yourself to your level of success. Because my mission is not to help other people have half the success I had. I want them to have 10 times the success I had, but I also want them to have fulfillment, which means joy and peace and love and family and experience the better things of life, not just chasing, you know, some magic thing up there that where they're going to create all this wealth and have an ego, man. Fulfillment is so much better than all of that other crap. So, you know, look, for me, it starts in my family. I got 5 kids. And I say, listen, I want you to create and become a better person than I ever became. I want you to have more than I've ever had. I want you to experience more than I've ever experienced. And I want you to create the level of success for you and your family and create a legacy for your life bigger than the one I created for mine. And if I can do that, by the way, that's my next world championship. Let me help you create more success. No. I want to help people create success where they believe that that level of success is impossible for them. Because I know that the word impossible is nothing more than a bold-faced lie, because I know everything's possible. Man, I got 3 world championship rings, right? So if I can win a world championship, you know, and I can play on world championship teams, and I can play with all of those great players and play in a country that I didn't even grow up in, man, why can't you? Right? So let's get it on.
And that's exactly it. And to that point, as I said, I read Relentless Success. I really enjoyed it. I read it not terribly long after you released it. Now that I know officially that you have another one, I'm going to have to find that one to get that one too. But tell the Blue Jays fans a little bit about what The Observer is about. Or is it?
So the Observer was a tough book to write. I'll never write one like it ever again. You know, it was a It was a story. I wrote it as a story. A woman plays the lead character, and she's a serial entrepreneur, actually grows up in Toronto, builds a big athletic chain. And in all of her success, she starts to buy her own press, and she becomes an awful person to other people. And then she collapses. Things happen in public markets and different things, and all of her success collapses. And ultimately, her son becomes kind of a person she learns from, because the son is following the guidelines of the grandpa, who is the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, who was a former pitcher in Toronto. And so there were a lot of times in this book I played the lead character, the woman. There was times I played the grandpa. There was times I played the son. And the marriage of the story, all the different stories in the book, were close to the life that I lived on the outside, but I made it as a story. And we figured that, hey, if we made a woman the lead character, people would never relate it, that I was really telling a personal story through her. For her, it was business. For me, it was athletics. And then, you know, going through the, you know, all the different, you know, the economic meltdowns and having to rebuild and reinvent. Well, she had to do it too. Going through cancer, where she lost her little brother, where she gave a bone marrow transplant to her little brother. And that marrow killed her brother, was just like me in my story. So it was kind of like me telling my story but with characters. And I would tell you that I had to write every chapter at least 9 different times. I just couldn't get it right. There's still one of the chapters in that book that I still can't stand, to be honest with you, but I couldn't get it right. And I finally was just so fed up. I'm like, just run it. Yeah. because it's different than me saying in my own words. I'm trying to build the story. And I was like, it's probably one of the toughest things I've ever done, was write that book. And it was a great challenge. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad it's over. And it's kind of like, but I got a couple other book ideas I'm working on, but it won't be that way. And where
a little straightforward this time.
I can go back into reflection and I can, share some stories with people to try to help them. And if they're in that situation in life, so we'll see what happens.
Good deal. Liz, Jason, I want to give you guys I've asked the last couple of questions here before we have some little extra silly fun.
You guys are going to have to go ice your ears down when this is over.
No, I'm like, I almost, I'm tearing up here. This is the most inspiring conversation I think I've ever had. Okay. I'm going to take it to be not as inspiring. So on the internet, on the Toronto Blue Jays Reddit, there is a debate going on about who this man in the picture is. Is it you? Do you know who it is? Somebody saw it in a bar in Milwaukee, and I've been asked to ask you if you know, is this you? Is it John Oliver?
That's not me.
Yeah.
It looks like John Oliver.
I didn't think it was.
No, that's not Olerud either. That's definitely not me. Look, I don't know who that is, but I'll tell you this. It has to be someone that probably grew up in Milwaukee and was a huge fan of Paul Molitor, but I don't know who that could be.
Great. This is going to take the internet down a weirder hole.
The internet as well.
The detective might have just figured it out there, Mr. Stahlbach.
So what's that?
You might have figured that one out there.
No. You may have figured it out.
I did. Yeah. The big thing for me, Todd.
We were in that same thing going, no, that's not Todd. Yeah. But it came good up in the chat, and everybody was like, wouldn't let it go. So it was had to be detective.
I think the big thing for me, Todd, is, and you and I sort of started a conversation on X to hopefully get you here. And I really, I got to say, my friends all day long were texting me, and like just the excitement level of, somebody that I grew up, a fan of, part of a team, two teams that just, they fulfilled something, in my life that I hope to see again. But I just, I started showing my kids. We started doing some work a couple of years ago with Brandon Geyer, who you probably know, former Cleveland Indian, does a lot of stuff very similar to what you were doing. But I have to say that my kids were watching some of the videos, and They really, 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 you know, because you have a story for it that goes with everything. I think that that's what resonates. And I mean, these are 13-year-old kids that are fairly baseball crazy, but they're also kids. So I feel like, you know, I just wanted to say thanks. You know, you've helped me and my kids, and I'm trying to, you know, use the sort of the things that I see, you know, from your dad and you down to my kids now too. Because, you know, I was the guy 5 years ago that the kids didn't want to get in the car with when they had a bad game. And I've come to realize that I can't be like that. I had to totally change my mentality and the way that I was thinking about it, because the person that I was thinking about was me. I wasn't thinking about them. I was selfish, and you've helped me come to realize that. And, you know, it's a big deal to have you here.
Man, I got to say something. Like, most men would never admit that right there, that they were like, you know, it's like emotionally they get so involved in their kid's game where it affects them emotionally. Like, most men would never. I would just say, man, big credit to you, because, and that's a big problem too with a lot of youth sports, is the parents get so wrapped up into it and so emotional, and it's as if they're almost living through their kids. And you know, one of the things, my dad, man, was the best at it. I don't know, don't ask me how or why and anything, but he was kind of like, I'll never forget, we're walking out of we just finished American Legion baseball game. My father was at the game, and we're walking out, and me and my brother, and I remember he said to us, he said, "Did you guys have fun?" We're like, "Yeah." And my dad said, "It didn't look like it." And he said, on that walk to the car, "If you don't want to play baseball, don't play." He says, "You know, it doesn't matter what you guys do. All I want you to do is what you want to do, and I want you to work hard to be the best at what you can do. And if it's not baseball, listen, if it's digging ditches, go become the best damn ditch digger you can be." And, you know, one of the things, and my dad didn't care. It was like, you know, and I tell my son, working with my son, and I tell my son all the time, I'm like, "Hey, if it's not your dream," I'm like, "bro, I love you just as much. If you want to, you know, I don't care what you do." I'm like, the love that I have for you as a father to the son isn't increased because you want to play Major League Baseball, by the way, because that doesn't have anything to do with it. And whether he does well, every game he plays, trust me, just like his dad, it's like, I had a lot of bad games. And when he doesn't play well, I say, "Hey, bro," I said, "listen, man, I did that. But I, like, don't forget, man, your dad lost over 100 games in Major League Baseball. Like, I had more than 100 days where I sucked and people booed me. Right? So get over it fast, right? And let's move on." But look, man, it's like, good for you. And you know, when they have a tough time, we need to put our arm around them. And when they have a great game and do something well, give them a high five, give them some knuckles, give them a hug. But emotionally, just, you know, it's so important to these kids to know that, because they probably felt how it was going to be getting in the car with you 5 years ago. And it's probably a drastically different feeling today. And good for you, man. I'm giving you a standing O, because that's a big deal. And I see so much of it in youth sports. Anyways.
All right. There's a reason I'm not umpiring anymore. That's all I'm going to say.
What's that?
There's a reason I'm not umpiring anymore for little kids anymore, yeah. Because, oh my God, the parents were worse than the kids were. I'll go back to coaching.
They're tough.
I got a couple of silly things. And my first one that I got here is, I'm sure, you know, you being a baseball enthusiast, you've heard of the Savannah Bananas at this point.
I have.
No? Basically, really? They're the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball. They dance, they play, they have celebrities come on the games and stuff like that. But, like, they'll have baseball players every once in a while come on when they're in certain cities. They actually sold out the Minute Maid Park and for the Astros. And they had Roger Clemens come actually and pitch an inning as a celebrity pitch.
I think I heard about one.
if you were ever offered an opportunity to go do something like that and try just getting out there and airing it out for one more inning, would you do it?
Well, let me say it to you this way. I'm not stepping back out there without airing it out, because I'm not.
There it is.
I'm like, look, and I just had a surgery about a year and a half ago, because you guys are going to think I'm really crazy now, maybe certifiably so, because I'm throwing BP to my son in the cages, and we start to get competitive against one another. And I mean, I start airing it out. I ripped my shoulder up and had to go get another surgery.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So no, good. Just so what everyone pleasure. Is clear, he got the best of me, and yes, I drilled him.
Let's go.
There you go. What's family for, right?
Yeah.
So that was actually a question I forgot to ask. Your one son is playing very high-end baseball now. How is it going? From the video I saw, I hear the kid can hit.
Yeah, he's really developed himself into it. I give him a lot of credit. He's a freshman at Cal State Fullerton, and he's a shortstop. But, you know, what people don't realize is that, you know, it was 3 years ago. He wasn't even good enough to start on his team. And he played very rarely. And I remember, actually, it was 2020, 2021. I said to him, I said, hey, you know, I was like, hey, do you like playing? He goes, Dad, yeah. He goes, it's what I want to do. And I said, well, what do you mean it's what you want to do? And he says, Dad, I want to play Major League Baseball. Now, I want you to think about this for a second. My first thought was, dude, you're not even good enough to play on your team right now, but you still have that vision. Now, the reason he wasn't good enough, it wasn't that he wasn't good enough. It was the fact that he was just so much smaller than everyone else that, you know, all these kids, they grew early and everything else. And, you know, and so they were kind of overmatching him at the plate. But defensively, he was great. And I said, well, do you really want to play? And he says, yeah. I said, okay, here's a path. So I just kind of laid it out and said, you know, it's not about how much you practice with the team at team practice. It's how much are you going to be willing to practice when the team isn't practicing. So he wore me out. He took it serious. That year, he would text me every day, Dad, where are you? Ground balls. And I'd be like, yep. And I never told him no. And whether he wanted me to throw to him, ground balls. That year, he fielded over 50,000 ground balls outside of team practice. The next year, he went back and he became the starting shortstop.
That's sick.
And he never turned back. And then he became, as a senior in high school, 2 years later, he became All-State and probably the best shortstop in the state. He went from not good enough, and all he did, it was a game of repetition and a game of math. Ground balls after ground ball after ground ball, because he was a middle infielder. And then he got stronger. He started to grow a little bit in height, but he started to work out, get stronger. He worked on his swing. He was either hitting off a tee or soft toss, or somebody was throwing to him like every single day. His senior year, the school called me in the fall, my son was with some of his teammates, was on the weekends, was climbing the fence and turning the lights on in the batting cage at the school. So they were breaking into the school and to hit, and it was like 11:30 at night on a Saturday night. And I remember the school called me, and I was like, wow. I said, what do you expect me to tell my son? That I would prefer him to be out partying? Or
that's what I was thinking.
And they're like, Todd, it's like, it's a private school. Said, okay,
just give me some keys.
I was kind of like, thanks for the phone call. And I hung up, and my son says to me, what do you want me to do? I said, keep climbing that fence, son. I mean, if you want to practice. And all kidding aside, I said, you know, I said that. And then his mother screamed at me that I was telling him to break the rules. And I said, well, why don't you go to the school and work out a program where you guys can go get the keys and actually go. So they ended up doing that. But, you know, the little kid in me was like, just keep. But what's funny was I seen the baseball coach in the spring, And he walked up to me and I said, "Hey man, sorry about TJ." He goes, "Sorry." He goes, "I wanted him to keep hopping the fence and keep hitting," you know? So, but my point is, you know, this kid has really been dedicated. He's worked hard. You know, look, I'm praying he gets everything he gets. It's a tough road, but, you know, I'm really proud of him. I'm proud of his work ethic. And, you know, he's like my father. He's not an emotional mess out on the field. He's an ultimate professional. He plays the game hard. I'm just super proud of him.
That's awesome. I think you should name your next book "Climb the Fence, Son."
Just go.
And you know, it's funny because I always say, you know, a lot of times on my posts, and I'll put at the end, "Let's climb." So
yeah,
maybe
there it is. That's in there.
Great, you know, great minds think alike. So. Do either of you have any silly questions before we get to letting Todd do his shameless self-promoting bit where we do everybody on this show?
Oh, man.
And
I got to go pick some kids up from baseball practice. So we
sorry, guys. Picks a click real quick. Liz, you actually have climbed back into the relevancy here on our little challenge that we always have on the show here, Todd. We pick a Blue Jay who we think is going to perform the best over the coming week before we record next Thursday. Last week, I had Vlad. Jason had Leo Jimenez. Liz picked Ernie Clement. And our last week's guest, the Looney Hot Dog Kings from the baseball stadium, picked Will Wagner. Ernie Clement had 9 hits and batted 400 last week. So I really don't think I can really terribly argue with that. So, Liz, you are now one behind Jason, who is currently in the lead with 7. Todd, you're going to get the guest spot back in here at this one, hopefully, with the with 5 wins. And then I'm back in the bottom of 4th. So, Todd, if you can pick a Blue Jay this week that you think is going to have the best performance this week, who do you think it might be?
I'm taking Guerrero.
Ah, that's the winning ticket right there.
Winning pick every week.
Code every week, usually.
I thought you were going to take a pitcher, Todd.
No.
Yeah, I agree.
No, because the everyday player can have one bad day, still have the best week. The pitcher has a bad day. They're out, man.
You got it.
Although if you pick Don Francis, maybe, and he has 2 no-hitters in the course of a week.
There you go. Yeah.
Liz, your pick.
I'm going to pick let's go with Spencer Horwitz.
Spence.
Yeah.
Jason, how about you so I can get you
going? I'm going to go Will Wagner.
Will Wagner. I'm going to go with Kirk. Because I like Alejandro Kirk, and he won me a few weeks ago, and I couldn't pick him last week because I picked him the week before.
There you go.
Going with the battery mate thing there, Todd, at least. So, Todd, this is your moment. Tell the Blue Jays fans about what you got going on in your life and what you're working on.
Well, you know, we stay busy, so I think that, you know, there's a couple projects. I have one project that I'm really, really excited about. Unfortunately, I can't announce it. And the reason I can't announce it is that it has something to do with the city of Toronto in Canada. So I'm going to leave it at that. I'm looking forward to getting back to Toronto and getting back to Canada. And this one project's got an opportunity and possibility to bring me back to the city. So, but I'm sorry, I'm teasing you now on that one because I can't announce it. The second thing is we just launched a nutritional drink, an electrolyte drink, and I partnered with Dr. Amy Shaw. She's a double board certified doctor and nutritionist. And we were just looking for, you know, there's so many products out there that claim to be healthy, but, you know, you kind of dig in and look under the hood and you find out, you know, they're loaded with sugar or this or that. So we launched Triple H Happy Healthy Hydration, a nutritional drink. You can buy it in powder form and, you know, no preservatives, no sugar. It's got probiotics in it. It's also got organic inulin for the brain. So brain, gut health, plus all the great electrolyte stuff that's in it. And it's, you know, metals tested by a third party. So it's a really pure drink. We got an incredible testimony today from a type 2 diabetic that runs the monitor and said that our drink actually even lowered their blood sugar level. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, that's awesome, but that was not the plan. So it's a great drink. We're proud of it. We're going to continue to develop it out, multiple flavors. And then we have other products. So we're going to create a kind of a nutrition line and kind of around my lifestyle. And then this fall, we're going to launch the 180 Degree Athlete. I'm really, really proud of it. My daughter's husband is my partner on that. He's the CEO of the company, he's a Division I football player, former Division I football player. We're working really hard on that. It's a digital platform to help the young athlete understand the mental game of baseball. And it's all the tools and the mindsets and the reflections, perceptions, visualizations, and all of these different things that you have to go through at the highest level. So I had great mentors of mine, Harvey Dorfman, who, you know, I was mentioning earlier, was the guru of the mental game of baseball. And he just, you know, so through his teachings and stuff, and it's a way for us to pass it on. And by the way, it's going to be ridiculously affordable. Sweet. To where even a high school kid on an allowance could buy the digital program. So it's not like, it's like it's going to cost all this money and this and that, but it's going to be a great product, because the other thing that I'm doing that I'm marrying with that is I'm bringing a lot of guys, Hall of Fame guys, former teammates, people that are still in the game to teach and coach these kids. So, you know, I want to bring a sports agent on and have the sports agent, here's what we're looking for in kids. I'm going to bring managers on, or former managers. I'm going to bring hitters, infielders, outfielders, base dealers, pitchers, awesome. Hall of Famers, managers, and to give them their shot at, you know, really teaching and directing these kids. So I don't think there's anything out there like it. So I would just tell you, you know, be looking for that if you're interested in that, or have young kids that are in the game. And
that's all on your website, right?
I believe it's going to be.
That's all on your website, right?
Yeah, so we'll announce it, and there'll be a page off of my website. So Todd Official is always the best place to go and find out what I'm doing. So
yeah. Cool. Deal. Well, thank you very much, Todd. We greatly appreciate it. And I would say this is probably, I think the gang will agree with me, this is probably one of the more enlightening evenings on our little barroom chat we've had here.
I think you can say favorite. Thank you very much. This might be my favorite.
Yep. Ever.
All right, I got a might be where he's still hedging, nope. But you know what? No, I'm just playing with you.
Wait, one more. So anyway, thank you very much. We greatly appreciate it. If you want to hang out for a minute after the show, I'll make sure you can get links to all this stuff too for your own personal
that'd be great.
Fun and everything. But Blue Jays fans, it's been a great evening here with Todd Stahlmeyer. Thank you again, my friend. We greatly appreciate having you on the show.
Hey, I just say this, you guys are always a lot of fun. You're very respectful. I appreciate it. I'll say to the Blue Jay fans, keep the faith. There's still a core of great players there. You know, you never know what's missing or what the missing thing is, right? Just like when we were there. And then all of a sudden, a guy by the name of Dave Winfield shows up and everything comes together. So, I just say to the Blue Jay fans, keep the faith and keep showing up. And there's an incredible core group of young guys there that have so much life left. I'll just tell you, I every year I keep picking the Blue Jays. One of these years I'm going to be right. I can't wait, I can't wait for them to win again and just see the excitement. Just be so, so cool. So, look, I'm rooting for them, and we'll keep pulling for them. So, but keep the faith.
Thank you again. And like I said, back anytime you want to chit chat or come talk about your new product when it's out, we're happy to have you.
Thank you. You know how to find me, boss.
So anyway, thanks everybody. Have a great evening. And if you happen to be getting ready for Thursday night football, we're sorry we had you late, but we're glad that you all stuck out for the Jaybird watching episode this evening. And have a great night. Go Blue Jays as always.
Thank you for listening to the Jaybird Watching Podcast. Please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Twitch at BirdWatchingGC, and our YouTube channel. If you want to support the show and get extra content, please consider joining to our Patreon at patreon.com/birdwatchinggc. Go Jays go.
Woo!
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.